So can Tucker Carlson, can Joe Kent, Thomas Massie, Marjorie Taylor Greene lead the way to a new America, perhaps a new party in America, a new type of government in America? Well, it may be something that is in the works. This is what you need to know and hear about on this day.
Not only did we fix it, we have military standing there watching it.
We know that the parties are aligned on the issues that matter against the population.
I think they misjudged Iran. They thought they were dealing with another Iraq or Syria or Saudi Arabia or Libya, and they weren't.
To believe that my engineers can create hypersonic missiles, to come to that, it is a big step in decolonization.
No ship now can enter Odessa and any other Ukrainian Black Sea.
There's really a lot going on this day, a lot to chew on, you know? This is The Effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. So many millions of you are watching every day, and I want to thank you for being there. And I want to start the show today by literally showing you a photograph. Take a look at this. That's Tucker Carlson's dining room table, right? He invited some friends. That's Thomas Massie. There you see Marjorie Taylor Greene at the very end over there. And you see Joe Kent there on the right. The other two women are their spouses, by the way. They're meeting with Tucker at his kitchen table to build what may be a new order or a new party moving forward in the United States. See, all of these folks that you see here, by the way, used to be with Mr. Trump, but they're now opposing what he's doing and the fact that he's turned out to be no different. Mr. Trump is turning out to be no different than Mr. Biden or Mr. Obama or Mr. Bush or Mr. I could go on. Yeah, the guys who came before him.
We know that the parties are aligned on the issues that matter against the population. Now, how do we know it's against the population? Because we have public opinion polling. And it may not be precisely right, but over time, we get a pretty clear picture of people's priorities. And the big things that the U.S. government, endorsed by both parties, are doing, which is spying on you more, moving an ever-growing share of gross domestic product to a smaller percentage of the population, invading countries, spending $1.5 trillion a year on a military they can't win a war, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all the things that they're doing, the big things. Population doesn't want those things.
Let me fill in some of those et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that he was just talking about. Billionaires are allowed to cheat in the United States today. More than ever, they're allowed to cheat. They're allowed to steal. They're allowed to own the Congress, own the president. They're rewarded for it. You know, those of us who grew up reading the Bible know that Jesus threw the money changers out. In Russia, Mr. Putin threw them out. He threw out all the greedy oligarchs in the 1990s and said, you will pay taxes from now on if you want to stay. And you will have to give back what you've stolen. The Japanese, for example, they do the same thing. Culturally, they humiliate almost to the point of harikari, right? They're business people. If they catch them in malfeasance, Mr. Xi in China, even, right? Shuts down Chinese companies overnight that are caught cheating the people. But in the U.S., it's a lot like France and Iran, right? Just before their respective revolutions that changed everything. It's unbridled malfeasance, hoarding, bribing, insider deals. All of this in the United States today is going unpunished. It's just bribery for bribery's sake. And by the way, it's done out in the open, politically and in the business community. And let me give you another et cetera, as Tucker says. As for the U.S. military, let's talk about that. The most expensive military in the history of the world. And yet, there is an apparent lack of readiness and competence that right now is explained mostly with just one word, Iran.
I think you simply have an example of a very large and expensive military establishment that over many, many years was reduced in size without making any accommodations with change that new technology, new forms of warfare required. And so it's a very wonderful, small but wonderful tribute to the armed forces of the Second World War and the Cold War. Nothing's changed.
Nothing has changed. Hear those words. Nothing has changed. So listen to what he just said and what that means when he says nothing has changed, which begs this question. How can nothing have changed in a military apparatus since the 1940s and 50s, since we now, today, spend up to $2 trillion on that defense and military apparatus? When we used to spend, I looked it up, $13 billion in the 1950s, and we did better. How do you do better with $13 billion as opposed to $2 trillion? I mean, the percentage between $13 billion and $2 trillion, you know what it is? It's less than 1%. So now we're spending tens of thousands of times more on defense, and we get a military that is shown up badly by Iran? Why? You know what it is? In many ways, it's about morals. It's about culture. The American culture of the 1950s, right? 40s, 50s, 60s, wherever you want to draw your line, it was about pride. It's about service. You know what it's about today? Pure and simple. Greed. It's about greed. And if you follow the money, especially in the military, you know what you're going to find out? That money, right, is being spent not on soldiers, not even on really better weapons, per se, as we're seeing in Iran, right? It's being used to make a very few people who own, run, or are associated with the military contracting corporations phenomenally rich. Phenomenally rich. But let me go back to the question. Let's go back to the question of Iran. Why them? Aren't you? I mean, I've been perplexed by it. I thought Iran was going to get its butt whipped. I really did. And I was there, right? Just before the bombs fell. Why them? How have they been able to show up the U.S. military? Listen.
I think they misjudged Iran. They thought they were dealing with another Iraq or Syria or Saudi Arabia or Libya, and they weren't. And they've gotten an education the hard way. And now, instead of recognizing the limits of our power and the prudent action that should be taken, which is to disengage and get out of this mess, I'm afraid we're doubling down on failure.
We're doubling down on failure, says Doug McGregor. So how is Iran different? I've been tussling with this, right, ever since I've been following and covering this war and going there and talking to Arachi and other Iranian ministers. To better understand this, I had a conversation last night with Professor Mohammad Mirandi. And this is what I wanted to know, how it is that they were able to develop such an incredible arsenal of weapons and missiles and rockets and drones and missile defenses without anybody even noticing that they were doing this at the time. Here it is. Can you explain to us how Iran was able to come up with all these hypersonic missiles and still be using them to this day and hide them in such a way and build them in such a way so that nobody knew that they would have it and then still be able to be so effective with them? Can you explain that to me? Because it seemed to come out of nowhere.
I think it's the decolonization of the mind. Where after the revolution, the Iranians began to believe in themselves.
Come on. I'm going to stop you. Venezuelans believe in themselves. And what happened to them? Cubans believe in themselves, and they're about to be taken. It's more than believing in yourself. You've got to have a big gun. Where'd you get the guns?
But the thing is that when you the decolonization of the mind goes further than that, Rick. You have to believe that you can beat them. So you have to start thinking how to beat them. Oh, can I match them with technology, with my technology? Of course
I
not.
See.
You can't defeat them. You have to buy F-16s. And if they give you F-16s, they're going to give you like the older generation stuff. I need an F-35. Okay, they may give it to you. They may not give it to you. And then when they give it to you, it's going to be like 2-3 generations older. And then what happens in war, the first thing they do is they bomb your airports and your F-35s are gone. And so to believe that my engineers can create hypersonic missiles. To come to that, it is a big step in decolonization.
You know, it's like a lot of things in life, right? It doesn't come from here. It's got to come from here. And in many ways, from up there, right? So is that the difference? Iran didn't build, you know, their military so that some people in the country could get rich, or some people who were associated with that company could get rich, or that the politicians could get fed money or something, as is the case with the United States right now. And then in the end, there's nobody there to say, well, it didn't work. Well, we got to do something about that. No, they just say, okay, who cares? The money's gone. We'll just come up with some new money. That's what happens. No, that's not what happens in Iran, right? It seems to me from my reporting that it built the equipment just like the United States did during World War II. They built it because the need, the motivation for them was existential, right? Existential. In other words, we got to all pull together. We got to do this for our very survival, for our children, for our families. That's the difference. And that's how Professor Morandi was trying to help me understand in this conversation where I was pushing back on him. The real reason Iran is winning, it's not about a magic bullet. It's about the magic in their hearts, I guess. Something America cannot, my country just doesn't have right now. We've had it. Maybe it's just, you know, maybe it'll come back. I hope so. Because America's busy right now, I guess. It's busy with some strange, bizarre stuff. Bizarre stuff that, by the way, it's not just coming from the left or the right or the Democrats or the Republicans. It's coming from both. I'll start with the Democrats. Here's an example of something I found just this morning, right? While the Middle East is on fire, we could be on the brink of a nuclear war with Ukraine because of NATO's need for more territory and more money. What are they talking about in the Democratic Party? Here's the ad, one of many that's running right now to elect a Democrat. This is Markey in Massachusetts ad. Listen.
At a time when transgender people are under attack, Ed is taking action, leading efforts to pass a transgender bill of rights, expand access to gender-affirming care, and ban dangerous defenses that excuse violence against LGBTQ plus people.
LGBTQ plus. You just have to wonder. I mean, really? Is that what we want to talk about? And what about the Republican Party? Let's talk about what the Republican Party's talking about. Here's the President of the United States last night talking about using the military, right? The U.S. military that we're talking about right now and how they're not doing a good job in Iran, apparently, right? But he's going to be using them instead to protect his dirty reflecting pool, a swimming pool outside the White House. Because, well, here he is talking about the reflecting pool while wars are being lost and economic conditions for average Americans are literally tanking right now. Listen.
Not only did we fix it, we have military standing there watching it. And if anybody touches it, that was the one mistake with the reflecting pond. They hadn't put up the cameras yet. They had enough up because you see what's happening. But if they would have had them up, we would have had it would have been a lot easier.
Reflecting pool cameras. Is he really talking about this? I mean, if you're watching us, and I know we got like 10, 20 million people sometimes watching us from all over the world, whatever corner of your world that you're watching us from right now, and you're asking, WTF? So are we. By the way, when it comes to issues that really do matter, there is Ukraine, right? Talk about existential. Ukraine and the war with Russia, which continues and continues. It's something Mr. Trump doesn't talk about anymore these days. He used to. The West in general, Europe, NATO, EU, more specifically, they don't even want to talk about it because of what's happening right now. And what's happening right now with the war in Ukraine is this, something they don't like. Russia is destroying what is left of Ukraine. And they're doing it with some very decisive actions. And they're doing it in three general areas right now. All right? Pay attention to these three parts, because this is where the geography matters. It's in the Donbas, it's in Zaporizhia, and of late, surprisingly, Odessa. More importantly, a blockade of Odessa. something Russian generals have long wanted to do, and they finally gotten the go-ahead to do just that. And guess what? It is, and I'll show you in a little bit, but here, it's making a huge difference already.
No ship now can enter Odessa and any other Ukrainian Black Sea port. And over the last 2 days or so, the Russians have taken this escalation a whole step further because Russian aircraft, Sukhoi 34 fighter bombers, have started to drop these fab precision-guided bombs on the harbour installations in Odessa and in other places, which tell us that the air defences of Odessa have completely collapsed so that Russian aircraft can now operate within range, bombing range of Odessa.
That is so important. That's huge, right? That the air defences have collapsed for the Ukrainians around Odessa. All right, and let me show you what I'm talking about. We're going to put a map together, so I'm going to show you the two regions. Remember I told you there are three geographic regions that we're talking about right now? It means that this, at least as far as Odessa is concerned, is no longer just about drones. It's about complete air superiority over the theater for the Russians that are now going to be able to use, again, aircraft and missile technology, right? What they're going to be able to do now in this area around Odessa for the first time is described best with one word, right? Control. They will now control this area and control the Black Sea, who goes in, who goes out, what they're going to be able to get. It appears the generals who've been arguing this with Mr. Putin now to do this for more than a year, apparently, but Mr. Putin refused because he didn't want to upset India and he didn't want to upset Turkey. And I guess that's understandable. You know, he didn't want all the countries in this region that use the Black Sea to be upset with Russia. Well, guess what? Those generals appear now to have won this argument. And you know what? Here's the most ironic thing about all of this. It was Zelensky who helped the generals win their argument with Mr. Putin. Why? Because it was Zelensky and the Ukrainians who started targeting Russian naval ships here. The Russians said, okay, we're not going to blockade this. We're going to let this everybody just go through as they want. And then Ukraine hit 100 Russian vessels. 27 of them were naval vessels in the Black Sea. And then Zelensky goes to Europe, and he brags about it. Look what I did. I destroyed the Russian Navy. Well, what? You know, most of our moms and dads always told us that, you know, if you win, you're not supposed to stand over your opponent and talk about him and make fun of him or something like that, right? So what's next? Well, with Russia now having dominion of this area right here and the ports around Odessa, right, which is how and where Ukraine in large measure gets its supplies, its military supplies and otherwise, to feed and equip its troops that are on the front, right? The situation on the front looking more dire every day, no less. We now have to ask the question, without this and with what's going on here, how long can Ukraine hold out? Europeans are looking at this. They're not talking about it, but you know damn well that they're looking at this right now because this is what's actually going on the front right now. You're not going to hear it from the West. You're going to hear it here, right? Because we're at least trying to look at it and be fair about it. If Ukraine's winning, we'd do the same thing. But it looks like Russia's winning this thing because of these conditions that we're talking about. Now, there's consistent reports that what is left of the Ukrainian troops around the Donbas and Zaporizhia, for example, are also cracking right now. Does it have to do with the fact that they're not being able to get a lot of supply? It could be. But whatever it is, we know this, around Zaporizhia, you know, it's huge because if those defenses of Ukraine are cracking in this area right in here, it's specifically important for their ability to be able to defend anything in this direction. Let me explain that to you. Because we'll start with Zaporizhia, right? Okay, that's Zaporizhia right there. That's Zaporizhia. If the Russians are able to take Zaporizhia, and it's looking like they're awfully close, that's the Russians right there in the red or pinkish, dark red or whatever you want to call it, area. If they're able to take Zaporizhia, they're going to go all the way through the Dnipro River to essentially the Dnipro area. And if they go to the Dnipro, they can go west toward a host of cities, or they can even go all the way down to Odessa that they now control, you know, because they have air superiority there. And Donbass in general, and we've been telling you about this, the Donbass in general, right, is almost a done deal right now. I mean, the Russians are, you know, knock, knock. They're knocking on the door. And they're soon, according to reports, going to be able to go into one city. And this is a really important city that I'm going to be telling you about right now. This is called Dobropilya. Look at Dobropilya right there on the map. See it right there? That's Dobropilya, right up there, right? Right under the sign that says Slovyansk, but actually it's further to the west. That's west of both Slovyansk and Kramatorsk, which is really important, right? I mean, Kramatorsk and Slovyansk are all but in the bag right now. I mean, the troops are just on the outskirts of the city and they're about to go in. Not taken yet, but having Dobropilya, right, gives Russia a way to cut off the military supplies that would be able to help the Ukrainians do whatever defense they can of Slovyansk and Kramatorsk. So it's almost like they're cutting them off. Remember, the Ukrainian defense lines come to about right here, right? And after that, they ain't got nothing, as we say. Pardon the ain't. My mother would be mad at me. But yeah, beyond this, it's going to allow the Russians, if they go through Zaporizhia and control Odessa and have these two cities, plus Dobropilya, then essentially it's kind of Katie by the door in many ways for them. And it's, you know, it's not me saying this. This is what the military experts that I read when I sit around looking at people who are actually looking at these maps, this is what they're saying as well. That, you know, it could be, who knows, Russian control of the Donbass could now be possibly just a matter of weeks. Okay, so when we come back, I want to introduce you to somebody, all right? When we come back, I'm going to ask this question. I'm going to ask it of him. Why would an American pick up his life, his wife, his 8 children, and move to Russia, of all places? I, Rick Sanchez, should be asking that. I'm going to introduce you to Joseph Schutzman. He has done that. Why? How's it going? What are his thoughts about all of this? We'll be back with him. But before we go, you know, I was just canceled by YouTube. I told you about this, right? They made almost all my work disappear because I don't work at CNN, because I don't work at Fox. If I worked at those places, I'd be fine. It's crazy, I know. So what's the solution? Do me a favor. This is what I've done. You may want to check it out. Go to bitchute.com. All my stuff is there right now. There's my page. And it's going to be there forever because they do not make content disappear. They don't make creators like Rick Sanchez disappear, like YouTube does to me. We'll be right back. No idea how much excitement we have in this studio today. All right, so let's do this. I want you to meet somebody. This is Joseph Schutzman. I've been wanting to have a show with him for quite some time. In fact, I've told my staff, and I had told Natasha, I said, you know, this is a fascinating story. Let's tell the story, because you're not the only one, of people who have come from Russia and decided to live in Russia who come from America. Now you and I have something particularly similar, right? Yes. You want to tell people?
Yeah, so my mother's side of the family comes from Havana.
Yeah.
And I was actually just getting a haircut today, and I walked outside and come out, and there's this oldest boutique in
guess what he brought me?
Sanctions. You know, that's what it is. There's this old boutique in Moscow. It's since 1962 in Moscow.
Selling Cuban cigars.
Selling Cuban cigars. It was like amazing.
So you are a Cuban American.
Yes.
Now living in Russia.
Yes.
Now the important part isn't the Cuban part, although there's a whole story behind that because of the relationship between Cuba and the Soviet Union.
Right.
But before we get to that, let's just talk about why you made your decision. People would want to know why would you leave the greatest country in the planet? You know, we're always told it's the greatest country in the world.
Yeah.
And by the way, and in many ways it is.
Yeah.
In many ways, it is.
At least in many ways, it was.
Yeah.
Let's put it that
way.
Well,
I think you may have a point there.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, you know, because, look, so we actually moved with six children. We've been here for 3 years now.
And
now
you continued breeding.
Of course, of course. Like,
you Catholic?
Little bit. Traditional Catholic. This is my grandmother, my abuelita.
Yes.
My abuela. She has 150 grandchildren now. Uh-huh. So, yeah, we're all about having the big family. So we're.
Me too, by the way. But we stopped at four and we went out and got a TV.
There you go. They don't have TVs in Russia, you know. It's a problem here. No.
Communist. No,
yeah, exactly. They don't want you to see anything. No, it's. We basically, it just had arrived to that it wasn't feasible anymore in America to protect the innocence of our children. You know, I was told growing up by my own father that children are like a beautiful white canvas. That's how they're come into the world. They have no expectations. And whatever you paint on that canvas, that's what it's going to look like.
What was it like they came home one day and said, Dad, look what they told us in school this month. We have to all worship Gay Pride Month. Whatever, or something like that, right?
The oldest was six when I left. We homeschool all of our children. And people said the same thing, you know, like, okay, well, you can at least protect your children.
Right.
No, I'm sorry. All of the children that are their age, they're going to school to public school, right? Mm-hmm. And they're going to meet one day. And they're going to have to live in a society that's like that. You know, people a lot to think about here and now, but we really have to start considering our future nowadays. This is why we have so many children. We got to actually bring more children into this world while, unfortunately, so many people are taking them out.
Yeah, and it's interesting because the experience I've had so far in Russia, and by the way, just to be clear, when I say this about Gay Pride Month, it's not about hating people who are gay or disallowing people for being who they are. It's about the promotion of something. I don't want my children to go to a school where they are forced for an entire month to celebrate something that I may not necessarily either A, agree with, or B, agree should be celebrated to that degree. That's all. I'm not saying you're not allowed to be gay. I hate gay. No, that's not what we're about. But it just seems like it's not the government's place. And the difference that I see in Russia, correct me if I'm wrong, is they don't promote or celebrate lifestyles or even, for example, I don't like the fact that we celebrate Hispanic Heritage Month in the United States. Why?
Why?
I'm Hispanic. I'm proud to be Hispanic, but I don't need a month.
Absolutely.
Or Black History, for example.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely true. But I will say one thing for Russia, that they do celebrate a normal society. Like, for example, a good friend of mine, Fabrice Sorlin, his wife just received the award for Mother Hero for having 10 children in Russia. They celebrate family here. You know, this is something, there's so much money.
Incentivized as well. It's not incentivized
in
the United States, but it is here. If you have children, you get a lower tax base.
Absolutely.
If you have children, you get other credits for food, et cetera. Mm-hmm. If you're a woman and you get pregnant, you get 14 months paid leave at your home so you can spend the rest more than a year with your child. That doesn't exist in the United States. We don't have
cheaper mortgage rates, sometimes no mortgage rates, cheaper car loans. Again, they act like they actually want to have children in their country.
Yeah.
Our country doesn't act like that anymore.
Is it children or family? It seems like there's a real... Here's something I noticed as soon as I came here. I went to the parks, right? I was living close to the city of Moscow. And every day I'd go for a jog, like a dumb, boring American. That's all I had to do, right? Put on jogging shorts and go for a jog. And I'm going through all these green spaces and all these parks. And what do I see? Benches, stories, history. I'm seeing things that are swings. I'm seeing things that are inviting families come spend time here.
Yes.
Be a family in this area.
Yes.
You know, and
to your point, Rick.
In the United States, by the way, and I gotta say this, the United States, our parks are locked.
That's right.
There's a lock on them. Yep. And I used to get mad. I say, I'm paying taxes. Why can't I go to the park? Oh, no. We've reserved it today for the such and such league of whatever the hell. I don't know. Soccer league. Yeah.
LGBT baseball.
Stop it.
No, but like to your point, you remember when you were a kid? I mean, I remember when I was a kid.
Do I ever?
Growing
up as a Cuban immigrant in Hialeah, man.
Come on. Right. But I don't remember the parks being locked then.
No.
I remember families going to the park. I remember that the big holidays in America were tremendously celebrated. Kids were running all over the place.
You got me talking about something that is so dear and near to me. I was one of the people who so looked up to the recreation directors who were paid by the city to be in the park to recreate children, that as soon as I got my first job, guess what it was? Working in a park, coaching,
no, really?
Coaching boys and girls baseball and football and stuff, because I thought that was important.
Yeah.
Today, you go to a park in America, there are no rec leaders.
No.
There's
no.
A guy who mows the lawn.
Yeah. That's right.
So, there's an absolute difference in how they view and incentivize what families can do together.
But you go to, you've seen this, you go into restaurants in Moscow, they have playrooms in the restaurants. Yes. I like showed up and I'm like, what, this is like kiddie paradise here.
Which sometimes is frustrating because the kids are loud.
Yeah,
but nobody, exactly. But people say, no, they're kids. Let them be loud. Let them play.
Exactly. That's the sound of their future.
We have that at McDonald's in the United States, but they have that at every restaurant here in Moscow.
That's right.
They have a place for the kids to play while their parents are dining.
That's even at 4 or 5-star restaurants. I mean, like high-end restaurants even they have them.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
What do you say when people in America ask you, what are you doing in Russia? Don't you know that's a crazy, dangerous, communist place and Putin this and Putin that and all that? Do you even talk to people anymore? Or do you...
Oh, no, I talk to lots of people. I talk to my friends and my family. Of course, I miss all of them. I don't really miss the society, especially in the post-COVID world. That place just got crazy. I mean, I sometimes show my wife, like, hey, look, this is what's going on. We look back, we're like, we used to live there. Like, what?
Yeah.
And it's really sad because when you're inside the fishbowl, you don't really appreciate how bad it really is because it's gradually increasing. And now you look back and you're just like, it's crazy. So I talk to friends and family and, you know, we still, you know, have, you know, good relationships with everybody, but nobody really understands, at least from a family perspective. Some of my friends, some of my uncles understand, and even they're very interested in this, you know, this story and how it continues. But I talk to tons of people who are not related to me, not my friends, who reach out to me from my channel, just seeing, they're like, wow, there's a guy with a large family here. He's making it. How is that possible? We want to do something like that, too. And big families. I mean, I've had one talking to one family that have 12 kids.
Wow.
Yeah, so.
Well, Russians love Americans.
They do. It's really shocking.
They're just totally in love with our culture and us. And it's embarrassing, is it? It is for me, and I imagine it's embarrassing for you, that they so... put on a pedestal our culture and our songs. And if you go to the mall and if you go anywhere, it's American songs, American music, American lettering, American banners, American everything. And we treat them like dog poop.
That is such a nice way of putting it.
I was going to use another word.
I know. It's just such
but I caught myself.
Yeah, yeah.
We really do. I mean,
true.
They've done everything but put their hand out. How do we join you? We want to be like you.
Yeah.
You know, let's combine our militaries. Let's combine our nukes. Let us join NATO. And we're like, no, get out of here, you Russian pigs. We don't want to have anything to do with you. We want to be at war with you.
Yeah. No, when I showed up in Russia for the first time in February of 2023, I was here on like the third day, and I finally turned to my friend. And I just said, why isn't somebody coming up and like accosting at me? I would I would understand if somebody just came and yelled at me, like, what is your country doing?
Yeah.
And he looked at me like kind of cockeyed and he's like, what do you mean? We love Americans. We just hate your government. And I was like, oh, I guess we could be friends. I do too. Like, that's the situation. And so talking with Russians, like you say, it's almost embarrassing how much they admire us. And even they admire us for things that aren't real anymore.
Yeah.
That's even sadder.
Well, that's because during the I'm glad you went there. What I find from Russians, especially the older ones, is because they lived through a lot of them, or their parents lived through the Soviet era when things did suck here. Mm-hmm. And they look to America as that really special place,
yes.
You know, that beacon on the hill, as Mr. Reagan once said. They don't know that's not like that anymore.
That's true.
They're still, because they grew up watching those movies and the TV shows and all that stuff, you know? You know, my assistant Marie's always, I gotta go to New York. And I'm thinking, New York is a pit. And it's like, no, don't go there.
No.
Yeah. Here's the thing with me, I think, though, Joseph. For me, it's about the corruption. It's just gotten so that everything is about either materialism, money.
Yeah.
And it's always been, the world has always been that way. But it just seems today, like, I mean, I'm not the most godly guy in the world, but I'm a Catholic and I go to church and I believe in God. And I just think that deep down, you got to be able to look at yourself and look at your God in the mirror or whatever it is you look at if you don't happen to be a religious person and find that thing in you that says, I'm doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. I can't see how some guy who's a 100 times billionaire or trillionaire can be in that place. Yeah. And there's every day more of them and more poor people. So that bothers me.
No, it is. It's something to be worried about and concerned about. And again, it goes back to the same thing as once you've been living in this same cycle over and over again, we've gotten desensitized to that. And you almost have to, like, cleanse yourself by leaving the country just so you can look back at it with a clearer lens. But it's really, really horrible. And it continues to get worse. I talked to my uncle back 5 years ago, and he called me up. He's like, Joseph, man, just the world is just getting so horrible. And I said, buckle up, buddy. It's going to get a whole lot worse.
But it seems like the West, our countries, whether you're watching us right now from the UK or Germany or the United States or any of these Western countries, you know, I find that it's worse there than it is in the countries we were taught to hate.
Yes.
I find more unity in China, in India, in the Middle East, and in Russia than I do in our own countries. Mm-hmm. And a hell of a lot less corruption. And when I look at the popularity polls, for example, or the polls they do on politicians, I find that leaders like Modi and Xi and Putin and these guys, they're more liked by their people than our leaders are. Mm-hmm. I mean, the guy in the UK, Starmer, was at 12%. This guy in France, Macron, is at like 18%. Yeah. Mr. Trump is at 36%. Putin, love him or hate him, he's around 70 or 80%. Yeah. So is she, so is Modi. Well, but they're supposed to be the bad guys.
and everybody's sitting back at home in America thinking that's not possible. How could somebody love a leader of a country so much that they would have 70 or 80% approval rating?
Right.
Like, that's unheard of. That's not possible.
Because they're comfortable with their lives.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's kind of what it is. And what do you think of Tucker and these guys? You saw I started the show with that today. Tucker is just fed up. And he, who's a friend of mine on the right, Jack Huger, who's a friend of mine on the left, because I don't think there's any difference in the end. They're coming together and trying to form something that gives the United States, our country, really, back to the people. Isn't that at the essence what the government is supposed to do? And where did they drop the ball and when did they stop doing that? And do you perceive that?
I do. I think I have probably not the most motivating perspective on that. It's unfortunate. I think Tucker's a great guy. I think, you know, Thomas, I don't know any of these people personally. You do.
Yeah.
But they seem like really genuinely good people. But the president said something several years ago, which I thought was really realistic, mm-hmm. I think. He just said, you know, people go into this public office in America and they think, okay, I'm going to change the world. I'm going to fix it all. And then the men with the black suits come in and they leave and they're different people. And I think in many ways that this may have been what even happened to Trump. Maybe Trump was, you know, actually sincere at the beginning. I hope that somehow we can break this cycle. But really, at the end of it, our Constitution was laid out pretty clearly that they knew that this was going to happen. They knew that this was going to be challenged. They knew that this corruption was going to sneak in. That's why we have these various amendments, like the freedom of speech, the right to bear arms, all of these concepts. But if you're not willing to use them, then you're doomed to failure. So I wish all of these guys, like, all the best. But Americans are going to have to find that within themselves to actually step up.
What does that mean? You said something interesting. The men in the black suits, like some people call them the administrative state, some people call it the black, the deep state, whatever the hell you want to call it. There's no question that guys like you and I, just average Americans, and so many other people who are listening to us in America, know that there is something in the background, something nefarious, which is running the game, right? They're being played in many ways. Doesn't that mean, then, that this country that we thought was a democracy is really not a democracy?
You know, democracies, yes, the answer.
Because if there's a force that is unmovable and unchangeable, that is called, in my name, in my game, in my way of looking at it, a dictatorship.
Yeah. No, look, democracies only survive by the virtue of the people that live in that democracy.
Yeah.
If your people are not virtuous, then you can't have a real democracy. The democracy falls apart. And this goes to your point about the corruption, et cetera. Yeah. There is so much corruption. This is how governments fall. Throughout history, we can look at them. The Romans, when they fell into their debauchery and their hedonism and their
Spanish,
corruption.
The
Spanish,
English. Yeah.
Everybody, one after the other. Yeah. We're at the end of an age, and people really need to start waking up to that and not being so... You know, it's not wrong to be proud of your country, but we need to expel pride from our sensibilities and learn some humility and look where other people are actually making improvements.
I've always hated exceptionalism. American exceptionalism, I think, is a dirty word.
Yes.
You know, it's like, well, you have to think we're the greatest country and we're the greatest and we can do anything we want because we're America. And it's like... talking about, you know, do you know what do you know about China? Mm-hmm. What do you know about Russia? What do you know about India? What do you know about Iran? Nothing. Mm-hmm. I think maybe that's a big part of the problem. You were talking about your children and you're worried about them growing up in America. If they grew up in America, they would be stupid.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry to say this.
That would be best case scenario, Rick. Stupid. I would even take stupid. Okay? You know what I'm talking about, all the other crap.
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking
about. Would they even be alive,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Would they have, you know, all of their human parts on them, perhaps, you know? Like, these are real legitimate concerns.
It is. That whole LGBT trans thing, I get very frustrated with it, and I don't understand it. And I think... There's also a question of immorality there, not because people should be beat up for what they believe, even if they've gone in wayward ways, but because I hate to see people being told that they have to be something that they don't understand.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's really what it is.
Right.
And they get mad if you don't understand it.
Yeah.
Like, you don't know that I'm a cisgender? And it's like, I don't even know what that means.
I don't know how to spell it.
It's like the identification with these symbols and this terminology just makes me absolutely crazy. Yep. And then their impertinence, their inability to have the patience to say, well, I know it probably kind of sounds weird to you, but here, I'll explain it to you. I would understand. I would have a conversation with somebody who understands things that I don't understand, but they don't do that.
Yep.
They're gonna like hit you over the head with it. Like you're a racist. You're a bigot. You're a whatever the hell it is that they call us. That is frustrating.
No, it is. But it's not even just that. It's like people become obsessed with this identity as opposed to how can they contribute to society.
Yeah.
I want my children to contribute to society, to a better future. That is not the way to a better future, to be obsessed with who am I.
Teach them geography. Teach them math. Teach them English. Teach them literature.
Yeah.
These are the things I want my children to know.
That's right.
And they don't.
Yeah.
And in it's like we were saying, man, in America, one of the most frustrating things is that I used to be a part of it. I mean, I anchored the news at CNN. I anchored the news at Fox. I anchored the news at NBC. These are places that made me feel like I had to buy in, and not only buy in, but expel this false narrative to people every day.
Yeah.
Until I started looking at myself in the mirror, and I'm saying, I'm lying to people. Why?
Mm-hmm.
They should know that things like the Ukraine war didn't happen because one day Russia just decided it wanted to invade Ukraine. You know, even if you don't want to like what they did, at least understand the motivation. But we're not allowed to.
No.
We're not even allowed to tell people that motivation.
No, not allowed to read about it. None of this.
And that's just one example. I just, you know, I could have used any, but we happen to be talking about that in front of the map today. That's a problem.
Yeah, it is. You said about the exceptionalism. And I think that there's another interesting point there.
Yeah.
Because we talk about an awful lot when we're feeling patriotic. Maybe after 9/11, for example, we talk very loudly about being one nation under God, which unfortunately I think that we're anything but, or maybe we're not talking about the same God as the Christian God anyways.
Yeah.
But exceptionalism is not a Christian concept.
No!
At all. Not in the slightest.
No.
Nobody, God's like, I want you to look at yourself in the morning every morning and say, I'm the best guy there is.
Jesus was anything but an exceptionalist.
That's right. That's right.
Jesus was about how do I bring myself down to be at the level of the people who are beneath me? How
wash
do I wash their feet?
Yes.
Thank you. My God, you did grow up as a Catholic. We were taught that as children.
Yes.
You humble yourself.
Yes. That's right.
You find something about everybody that you can appreciate and love.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's what I love about Russians. They have their own faults just like anybody else. Their country has its own problems just like any other country has problems. Not the same problems. But they're humble people. They're people who don't try to boost themselves up over everybody else. They approach like friends. They still remember the meeting at the Elbe. Yeah. They remember that every year in Moscow when Russian soldiers ran and shook American soldiers' hands. I was talking smack about what was going on in our military to a Russian paratrooper. These are special forces in Russia, right? These are the top guys. And I was smack talking because I was like, this is crazy with all this. And he's like, hey, careful. We were taught to respect those Marines. We were taught to respect those Marines. He's like, we have a tremendous amount of admiration for the Marines.
Yes. And you're like,
what?
Right.
What?
We don't.
No.
In America,
no.
The World War II is all about the Holocaust. Yeah. And you know, with all due respect to all the horrible things that happened to many of the Jews at the time there, it's a big part of the story, but it's not the only part of the story.
Yeah.
We celebrate World War II in Normandy, and the big kahunas there are the French.
Yeah.
And when last time I checked, the French lasted about a month and a half in World War II.
Yeah.
So why are we celebrating the French?
Yeah, exactly.
And the Russians are not allowed to go.
Mm-hmm.
They're kept
That's
out.
Right.
The
That's
guys
right.
who actually won and defeated the Nazis mm-hmm. and lost 27 mm-hmm. million people. No.
Yeah.
You guys stay out. We're gonna have Macron give a speech.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's like, do you not know your history?
Mm-hmm.
It's okay. You want to hate Russia? Hate Russia. But know the story of World War II.
Yes.
That's like this woman That's right. who works in the EU, Kaya Kallas. She recently said, I don't understand how the Chinese and the Russians have anything to do with World War II. It's like, are you stupid?
Mm.
I mean, you heard that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But again, she's just lying to the freaking camera for crying out loud.
Or is she just stupid?
No, her father was one of the main characters of the Communist Party in her own country.
Yeah.
For crying out loud. Her husband does business in Russia, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
What are you talking about? You know the gig, and you're just playing stupid. She is stupid.
Yeah.
But I think she's playing more stupid than she's coming off as, let's put it that way.
What's the difference in the end? I don't know. Do you think these people in like places like NATO and the EU, they're all rich, they're all bankers. They all want to go to war with Russia. They attacked Belgrade. They attacked Iraq. I mean, they're kind of warmongers. Do they do it because they're evil? Are they bad people?
Is who bad?
Ursula von der Leyen, Mark Rutte, Kaya Kallas, all these Europeans who we're reading about. I could read you. I could pick up my open my laptop right now, and you'd see. I could quote you like, "We gotta destroy the Russians. Yeah. We got to go to war here. We got to go to war there. They want to conquer Iran. I mean, they're like, what is it? What happened?
They are evil. That they absolutely are evil. You know, it goes back to what I was talking about. With regards to how the Russians perceive Americans. They have a superpower that is somehow unique maybe to Russians, that they're able to separate governments and people. You know, we think of Russians as all one, but the Russians can actually separate government and people.
Yeah.
And the governments are all corrupt. They're all satanic cabals in their own right.
One of the things I love about Russia is the devotion and respect for religion and the churches. Mm-hmm. My wife and I went to Uglich this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
We took a boat there. It was fantastic. And we spent most of the time understanding the history of Dmitry and the history of what happened in the old Russian folklore. But, you know, and I'm not going to bore people with that. But all the people in that town of about 30,000 people or so, they all have a devotion and they take care of their churches and they respect them. And you see them out there cleaning mm-hmm. them and going to them. When did Russia, a place that used to be a communist country, become so religious? And is that one of the things that attracts you now? Because you're a Christian, practicing, right?
Yes, practicing.
With your family.
Traditional Catholic, No, I have a tremendous amount of respect for the Orthodox here and how they've rebuilt so many of their churches. Actually, I'm working right now to help a Orthodox priest with the rebuilding of one of his churches in Nizhny Novgorod.
And just so our viewers understand, during the Soviet era, a lot of those churches were taken down and turned into something
Absolutely.
Else because they just didn't believe in that. Since the Soviet era, they've been going from town to town and rebuilding the churches.
Yes. 30,000 churches under Putin's presidency, I think, have been rebuilt, restored, renovated.
And we're losing churches in America.
Absolutely, closing them. Catholic diocese is closing it all the time. Bishop's got to play golf, right?
Where is this story, right? That nobody knows
the real
this.
Stuff.
If
the
I didn't
stuff
have you
matters.
Here talking about this, nobody would know.
It's very sad. I went out to Nizhny Novgorod region, which is Divyevo.
I love it.
Amazing place, spiritual place. It's a chosen home of the Mother of God in Russia. And we're going to do a documentary on this. And this is things that we as Westerners need to understand as Christians. that we need to be seeking friendship and understanding.
Right. Why not?
We have the same God, for crying out loud. Can we not actually work on that?
You were instrumental in bringing Candace Owens over here. And thank you for that, because I had a wonderful opportunity to spend some time talking to her about a lot of important things. But what was your reason for that? How did you connect?
Well, that's a very good question. So a lot of people have asked me that question. Really, the only thing is that I'm a traditional Catholic, and Candace and her husband are traditional
Catholics.
She
talks about it every day on her show. I know, sometimes too much, but anyway.
Yeah. No, people need to start realizing that people are genuine about their faith.
Yes,
that they were
and
looking
she
for,
is.
Yes, she is.
And God bless her for that.
Yes.
Absolutely. And George, her husband.
And George.
Yeah.
And so I wrote a letter. I had some mutual friends, ironically, in Australia that helped us get the letter to her. And she read it, and George called me back a few days later after I sent it halfway around the world and come back. But again, I asked them on a spiritual mission. And that was how that was.
You know
offered
what?
To
you,
them.
Do you know what? You know what that says? And you know what I love about her? Mm. There's one word that you're going to love because you're Christian. Fearless. It's important in life to have something that's bigger than yourself, and that's what gives us the courage to go throughout.
Yes.
And I believe in that. And I believe in Candace in that she's fearless in what she says. The things she has gone after and criticized, and the things that to a certain extent Tucker and some others are now doing, that's an act of fearlessness.
Yes.
Her coming to Russia and letting the world know she's in Russia, her appearing with Rick Sanchez on RT. I've got a million people who love me. Oh, my God, you're doing great. I love Rick Sanchez. And then our bookers will call him and say, hey, you want to come on? Well, yeah, I love Rick, but, you know, RT. And it's like, courage is when you do what you're not supposed to do.
That's right.
And that's what she did when she appeared on the air with us, because 100%. It takes guts.
It was a great interview. It's a fantastic
interview.
I've loved watching it. And yes, she is absolutely fearless.
She's real. So we had a conversation just like you and I are right now.
Yeah.
You know, the Kremlin sent us my notes that I have to ask you. And
Oh, is that?
You made a mistake. What did you say about Putin again? You're out of here.
Oh, boy. All right. Time. We're off. No, fearless is it. My father's chosen motto was fac recte nectime.
Yeah.
Do good, fear nothing. Yeah. What is there to fear? We have a short period of time on
this earth
to make a difference.
Imagine being remembered as a coward. Yeah.
God help us. Rick.
I love you, man.
Pleasure.
What a great conversation. So nice for you to come in here and have this conversation, be able to catch up with you. And,
likewise.
You know, as a fellow American in Moscow, it's kind of cool to be able to share some notes and say, yeah, did you see? Yeah, I experienced that too. And it's really a great experience. An American in Moscow, in this case, Dva.
Yes.
That's it for us. Thanks so much, Joseph. Well, that's it for us. What a great conversation. I mean, this guy, you know, as De Niro would say, this guy right here. It's nice to be able to have a real conversation with real people. It's what we try to do here. As you notice, I was kidding about no questions that were sent to us or anything that we had to ask. I prepared nothing. I've got a couple of little pieces of scribbles on here, and that's about it, because I knew that when you go into real conversations with real people who are smart, the conversation carries itself. It's what we do. By the way, you can find us on X, you can find us on Spotify, you can find us these days, where I put a lot of my stuff on BitChute, by the way, and I want it to be there because they promise it'll never be taken down. Thanks so much for being with us. And most importantly, really, thanks so much for letting us into your homes. Good night, and I'll look for you next time.